This episode of The Entrepreneurs was first broadcast on the 3rd of October 2012 on Monocle 24. The Entrepreneurs, in association with Pictet. Hello and welcome to The Entrepreneurs, Monocle 24's weekly business show. I'm Sophie Grove. To start off this week's episode, we'll chat with Larry Light, the founder of eyewear brand Oliver Peoples, about how he reinvented the figure of the chic, bespectacled American.
We decided that we would put a search for and try to buy vintage frames or original frames from doctors across America that maybe have old stock.
And we'll find out about the company breathing life into Britain's ailing, ancient glassblowing industry.
For us, the craft side of it and making it in this country by hand in our studio is really important to what we do as Rothschild & Vickers.
We'll meet a British Columbian designer set on using pulp to start a new furniture brand.
And I was always obsessed because I'd look at a pulp log and my guys would see a pulp log, but I'd see a piece of furniture. That's when I was inspired to do something with the waste.
We'll also meet a company capitalizing on Mongolia's cashmere heritage. We'll pop into the World Retail Congress, give the global hairdressing chain Tony and Guy a branding overhaul with our friends at Wink Creative, and we'll hear some management tips from the famed restaurant consultant, Nicholas Lander. All that and much more, coming up this week on The Entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 51 of The Entrepreneurs. I'm Sophie Grove. We all know that eyewear can be transformative, and no one is more familiar with its power than Larry Light, the California founder and creative director of the company Oliver Peoples. Larry set up shop with his brother on Sunset Boulevard in the 1980s and began crafting a brand that was snapped up by the city's residents. Larry designed iconic glasses for the likes of Andy Warhol, but the business was more than celebrity. It was about identity. He's been credited with redefining the figure of the cerebral intellectual American. In many ways, the success of Oliver Peoples revived the classic shades of the 1940s. Early this week, he dropped into the studio to talk about his strategy for growth and the origins of the company. It all started with an incredible find, a tranche of unworn vintage frames from the 40s.
In 1986, my brother and I decided that we should do our own store up on Sunset Boulevard, Sunset Plaza, where we remember in the 70s there was a famous optical store there that catered to Elton John, Elvis Presley, Sammy Davis Jr., and all these big stars. And that went out of business long ago, but we decided to open in that area, in that iconic West Hollywood area. But the real spark came from my brother and I thought that there didn't exist eyeglasses that were sort of simple, sort of early Americana type styles that we were aware of, that we learned a little bit in school. We did our studies and we loved some of the eyeglasses that were made in America between 1930, 40, and 50. There were factories in New York. There was American Optical. There was Chiron Optical, Bausch & Lomb. There was many cool companies that made lenses and frames, and they didn't make them in Europe. And those are the type of glasses that John Lennon wore and many people in the 50s and 60s. So we decided that we would put a search for and try to buy vintage frames or original frames from doctors across America that maybe have old stock. And we got lucky and we came upon a liquidator who was liquidating an estate from some company that was way 50 years old or so, and had this whole storage room of eyeglasses and articles and machinery and lenses. So I flew to New York and I flew there and I saw this place and I said, oh, I don't know if I can use all this, but how much do you want for the whole room, you know? And I made nothing of it. And I said $6,000 US dollars. So I wrote him a check. He shipped it to Los Angeles, and then we all huddled in the house. And when it came, we felt like we hit a gold mine. And we said, well, this is it. Okay, we'll open the store and we'll call it Oliver Peoples, the name of the person who owned this. It sounded British, so it kind of sounded like, you know, an eyeglass is kind of older. It actually sounded British, so people thought maybe it was. So we kind of liked that idea of having that soul, that name, some history, some story that was really true and real. And we took all these frames and we played with them like you do Rolex watches and vintage. You change colors of them, you bend shapes around them, you modify them. And we were tweaking them and making them, you know, all these frames into a large variety of original vintage frames. None of these were ever worn. They were brand new in packages. And we had the lenses, so it was a great story. So we opened the store with that, and immediately we had a really huge response. And in that area, the kind of people that responded were actually photographers, models, writers, producers, film, everything, music. And they traveled to Los Angeles for business, and the word was, go see that store, all our people. So people were buying these original frames that had no name on them other than the real brand, American Optical or Bausch Lomb. So, but immediately, like, we knew that we had to make our own frames inspired by that, not copy these.
Do you think part of your success is tapping into that iconic intellectual sort of Americana, that sort of Woody Allen sort of introspective, very cerebral look? Do you think that is really part of your business strategy from the beginning?
We knew that the clientele that we are like and what we felt people would appreciate is there weren't available these kinds of frames. Everybody was trying too hard with color and shape and design and logos and square, large frames. And we knew that very recognizable, stylish people don't wear stuff like that. So they're either not wearing their glasses or they're going to these swap meets and vintage and buying, like, and that's what Johnny Depp and that's what Woody Allen, these are all sort of vintage frames. You couldn't go to a new store and buy those. So at that time, there was no place to get them unless you found them at a swap meet. So when we came about, it was like, wow, finally there's a company that is kind of authentic, you know, and actually you can't tell if the frames are new or old. And they're original. They're not direct copies. They're sort of inspired by that. But they kind of have that intellectual feel. So our glasses were a very intellectual look. And I think that changed the direction of eyewear globally, because over several years, all the brands and companies, when they slowly found out about it, wow, I mean, that brand is, those frames, those are nice, they're coming, you know? And then slowly every manufacturer in the world then became to make their collections all vintage, vintage, vintage. And that's when Giorgio Armani and Calvin Klein kind of blew it up around 1991 or two. And their caption was vintage eyeglasses. So it definitely changed the whole direction of eyewear. We were just wanted to be only in small stores around the world, just a few, you know, so that we could plant the seeds and that people, when they copy us, we figured eventually they would at least know that this is the original company. So I left for almost a year and went every city, big city, London, you know, Germany, France, Japan, and met editors, and I showed them these designs. It didn't have to speak the language, really. They just, could I borrow them? And sure enough, 6 months later, we were on the covers of all the magazines. I mean, inside spreads like French L, you know, and all the major magazine, fashion magazines all over the world. Three or four in each city I went to straight, the best ones at that time. And they all swooped them up. And that's how, that was like our internet, because that confirmed, and everybody who reads fashion magazines and all that then, and that's the only thing you can read, saw that, and our name was then really established.
Those editors probably wanted to look clever themselves.
They did, and it worked well. And I have the archive of all these editorials with the Naomi Campbell, Claudia Schiffer, and all those famous models. And they were actually customers too. We would then see them in the magazines, and then they'd come into the store and we'd go, that's interesting.
And in terms of that strategy, kind of holding back, you know, you kept your production, as you say, in Japan. Yeah. Where do you go next? What do you think the future of the brand is, and how do you want to sort of expand from here?
That's just where we went in the beginning, to Japan. We've currently used manufacturers from all over the world, depending on the design, materials, and what we want to use. Where do we go from here? It's pretty much the same vision that was probably written back then, not written, but understood. And that was to continue to be sort of mystique, have a mystique, and have a discreet brand where we don't put logos and we don't have to expand to every store. And so we continue to want to reach the better retailers around the world and not expand so much to be available to everyone. And we have retail stores of our own, more than we had back then. It was one, now there's like seven. So pretty much, I think it's the same formula: discreet branding, exclusive distribution, simple, great design, you know, high quality, and great press, you know, and great exposure through being humble and not really trying too hard, and really, really continuing to understand who we are targeting and who our customers and how the designs are supposed to look to appeal to that audience. Because if you lose it and you get too far out and the designs don't wear for that kind of look that we think is really, you know, people love about us, I think it's to continue to keep the vision.
What advice would you give to, you know, a young entrepreneur setting up in this business or setting up in business, in life? How would you, you know, what advice would you give to your younger self even?
Funny you say that, but I have a son who just was probably in the same position as the people you're saying that are wondering how you get into this business. You know, he's 28. He's worked for Oliver Peoples for a little bit. Wasn't sure what he wanted to do. He now has started his own retail business and has a wholesale business. It's funny because you wonder, well, what do you do? How do you start today? It is very, very different than how I started. And if I was younger, I would probably be doing it with the approach that he's doing it now, if I was starting all over. But I would say that what you have to do is for sure know that you're passionate about that industry, not just because I want to do something, make some money, and how do I get from point here to there. It's more like the journey. You got to be willing to take the journey. You got to know the business fully. In other words, you have to have, it's better if you sell glasses in a shop, so you work with real people, and then you get the wholesale part, and you're working now with buyers, and you combine that knowledge because you have to and be inspired as to who my audience is and what they're looking for. So you have to really do your homework. You have to love it and you have to enjoy the journey of what you need to do to educate yourself. There's no limit to how successful you can be if you're really clever. But to be clever, you have to know what everybody else is doing and if it's successful or not, and find your path and why people are going to come to you and not just keep going to them.
That was Oliver Peoples founder and creative director, Larry Light. Now, from Sunset Boulevard to one of the most remote, ethereal landscapes in the world, the Outer Mongolian Steppes. It's a little-known fact that Mongolia is the world's second-largest producer of cashmere. The Mongolian cashmere goat is key to nomadic society. Its fur is considered the finest and softest in the world. But Mongolia's cashmere industry has also been troubled by issues surrounding quality and mislabeling. Manufacturing in the country is still in a nascent phase, and cashmere is predominantly exported as a raw material. That's something Mongolian-born designer Ayuna Tessendorf sought to change. She and her Swiss-Ecuadorian-British partner David Bernasconi set up the cashmere brand Ayuna in 2002. It's inspired by the wild plains of Mongolia and London's cosmopolitan creativity. It's also made in Mongolia by skilled craftspeople. I caught up with the pair on a sunny roof terrace during the London Design Festival to talk about Mongolia's untapped potential.
I am from Ulaanbaatar, which is the capital of Mongolia. But my father, he was originally a nomad. He used to take care of goats and sheep in the very far away eastern part of Mongolia, who ended up being a lawyer and Secretary of State of Mongolia, etc. But as a country, Mongolia is very much, for me, I wouldn't say it's in terms of specific design inspirations, but just the attitude to general life and situations. I think that helps when I'm designing here in London.
And you're working with cashmere. I wondered how important that actual material is to Mongolian society, to Mongolian culture, to the nomads that you're talking about? Is it part of their tradition?
Absolutely. Mongolian cashmere is one of the biggest elements of Mongolian economy. It's very much, at the same time, it's very much a lifestyle of Mongolian nomads. So you can imagine the nomads living in this beautiful countryside. You cannot imagine how beautiful these valleys and mountains are. And they just live as one with nature, and they take care of the goats. I find that life really, really inspiring. It's really beautiful, the just harmony with nature. And when I ended up in London, it was in a way a natural process for me to be working in Kashmir, because being Mongolian, living in London, interested in design and loving Kashmir and grown up loving Kashmir, it was such, in a way, a natural process to start this business.
And your Kashmir and your designs are very unconventional. Are you trying to sort of take Kashmir away from the territory that we're so accustomed to, you know, just wonderful textures, but often V-necks and, you know, picnic blankets and cardigans? There's lots of traditional styles in Kashmir. Do you think that, you know, sometimes it's misunderstood and needs to be used more innovatively?
Absolutely. At a certain point, Kashmir almost became a bad word, because you could buy it at the corner shop, basically. And that's, in a way, we almost don't want to use Kashmir, because we're more about design. And what we're trying to do, is, and I hope we're achieving that, is to show different aspects of knitwear. And I don't even want to call our, for example, women's wear knitwear, because for me, it's not knitwear, it's just a beautiful dress, slightly abstracted, completely comfortable, but beautifully understated, quietly confident. Those kind of pieces which were really close to our design aesthetics.
And when you sort of conceived of using Kashmir and going back to Mongolia, how do you make sure that you're sourcing the right Kashmir? How do you make sure that you're not falling into the trap of this Kashmir, as you say, that you can buy in a corner shop? Maybe not, but it is everywhere. And is that part of your business model, to really source the best Kashmir? And is there an ethical element to what you're doing?
Well, we work exclusively with Mongolian Kashmir from Outer Mongolia, which represents 20% of the world's raw fiber production. A lot of the desertification problems have been centered in Inner Mongolia. They are starting to happen in Outer Mongolia. And we feel that the best way to deal with this is to increase the value added in the source of the Kashmir, so in Mongolia, in our case. So we work directly with factories in Mongolia trying to produce in Mongolia, and thereby increase the amount of the size of the pie that stays in Mongolia and trickles down to the Mongolian nomads themselves.
So have you been on site to look at where your Kashmir is coming from? And can you tell me a bit about, you know, what this place is like? Was it a bit of a shock to get there and find this wonderful land, as you're saying, this beautiful, I mean, the steppes of Mongolia are sort of mythologized as being one of the most sort of incredible landscapes. Do you think that sort of really is part of the sort of brand of the business in a way?
Very much so. I think I should let Oyuna speak a little bit about that, because the land and the landscapes are very much part of her source of inspiration. The land is beautiful. It is vast. It's the size of Western Europe. It's populated by 2.5 million people. That's the Mongolian population as a whole. And half of that population relies on nomadism and herding to sustain their livelihood. On the one hand, they have cash crops, which are Kashmir, and herds that they raise for nutrition and protection, so clothing.
And David, when you set about building your business model for this brand, did you have a customer in mind? I mean, Ayuna's just spoken about sort of the philosophy, in a way, of this nomadic sense of a necessity and a beautiful object, and just, you know, cherishing that one thing rather than this sort of absolute inflation of people's wardrobes that's happening around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about who you have in mind and who your customer base really are?
Our customer is a global nomad. That's a term that we use. And what we mean by a global nomad is somebody who will travel a great deal, both for work and for pleasure. Some people have multiple homes. They, by definition, will take garments and protection with them in order to keep themselves warm, in order to look great. And these customers are the ones who we're targeting, the ones who are constantly on the move, but who are also in touch with the values that Oyuna just described, which is keeping possibly that less is more.
It's a very interesting thought that you can bring together the idea of this ancient nomadic culture and very modern sort of cosmopolitan life. Do you think that those two things really are actually quite synonymous and that they work well together in terms of your vision for the company?
I think so, because we are all, as human beings, we're all nomads. We all move from one place to another. And historically, no one's belonged from one place to another. There's not a single country in the world where it's only certain people there. So nomadic lifestyle, it's very much part of the humanity, and it's becoming more and more part of humanity with the people mixing, globalization. Yes, definitely.
And do you feel that Mongolia really has potential as a brand? I mean, you mentioned the positive connotations, we talked about the beauty of the landscape. Is there potential to kind of develop in other areas? And is there potential, cultural potential for it to really sort of go a bit further than what we're seeing at the moment?
Absolutely, because there is a very big deal of great craftsmanship combined with the modern machinery. As you know, the world is developing so fast, and even in Mongolia, the factories we work with, we have the high latest German and Japanese machinery. So high grade craftsmanship combined with high technology could result in a really, really luxury product when it's really managed well, and if products are designed well, and there is a brand story. Absolutely, yes.
That was my chat with the Mongolian-born designer, Oyuna Tissendor.
When I graduated from business school, I couldn't imagine taking orders or generating wealth for someone else. This overwhelming desire for autonomy spurred me on. That was Jacques-Antoine Grandjean, our internet entrepreneur, quoted from the Pictet report. Pictet, experts in wealth management.
For decades, Detroit has been a poster child for the misfiring American dream. But amid block after block of post-industrial decline, there are signs that Motor City is jump-starting its economy, as Monocle Films discovers.
The phrase triple bottom line echoes around the city among small business operators. There is a dual desire, a sense of pride even, to make a success not only for themselves, but also for Detroit.
Retooling Motor City, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. Britain's glass-blowing tradition spans back to medieval times. But in recent years, high fuel costs and a dip in trained artisans has meant much of the industry has moved offshore. Rothschild and Bickers are among the last glassblowers in the UK and do an impressive trade supplying high-end lighting to contractors around the globe. Monocle's Adrian Craddock met with one of the co-founders, Mark Bickers, at the company's studio in Hertfordshire to discuss how he turned his love of glass into a successful business.
For us, the craft side of it and making it in this country by hand in our studio is really important to what we do as Rothschild & Bickers. It's been suggested to us many times to get them made abroad, but it's just something that we're not interested in. You know, the making, the fact that every piece is completely handmade, no moulds are used, that each one is a unique piece is really important to us. We don't want them to be a mass-produced product. We want them to be a crafted thing that people sort of cherish and really keep for a very long time.
Do you think that England is having another kind of resurgence of great hand-blown glass? Or do you think that it's more specific in these very niche kind of markets?
of all the glassmakers I know, a lot of them are doing really well at the moment, and it's great. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the more buoyant the whole sector is, the better it is for everybody. But on the sort of craft handmade level across the board, everybody seems to be having a better time of it. Mm-hmm. I think as recent as 5 years ago, it was a lot trickier. Small-scale manufacturing has its real place now.
How do you then go from turning this passion into a business? I mean, because traditionally they're quite different worlds in a way.
Yeah, really good question. That's the hardest bit. Yeah. Absolutely the hardest bit. The making of it becomes relatively easy. Making it into something that can sustain us and the people around us that we need to and pay all the bills for this place, that's the hard bit. We've taken some decisions along the way that have really stood us in good stead, and also some of it's luck. But I think we've always worked really hard to put ourselves into positions where we can get opportunities. We were quite lucky that we picked up some quite big clients quite quickly, and that's allowed us to expand the business relatively quickly for the sort of age and size that we are.
When you say you've been lucky with some of the decisions that you've made, what exactly do you mean by that? What are the big kind of things that have set you up?
I think the biggest one that we did to begin with was that we just made a really definite decision to not sell to retailers, basically because the price point that we were going to sell at, we knew we wouldn't be able to deal with our markups and sell our products sort of as much as we can make them to our production level. So we very early on decided to chase a different market. In hindsight, that was really good. I can say that. Hindsight's a wonderful place to be to say that kind of thing. But it was a really good decision to make.
At the time, were there kind of nerves as to whether that was the right decision? Because I imagine, when you think of, beautifully hand-blown glass, the first thing that kind of comes to mind, well, sometimes at least, is, in retail stores, it's kind of beautiful pieces that you see in kind of boutique shops in Chelsea or whatever. Was that a big decision and quite a nerve-wracking decision to make?
Yeah, I think it was. We started to get jobs down that kind of line anyway, and we thought, well, this seems to be heading in the right direction. Let's keep going down that road. But for certain, it was that was the well-trodden route. That's certainly in the studio glassmaking sort of fraternity, it was that you sell to galleries and shops. That's a well-trodden route. And to solely do it the other way around did feel a bit risky, but actually it was the right time for it, and it was the right time for us. We had the right products, and in hindsight it really worked. I think that set us up to move on to where we are now.
So what are you actually making now?
So we're going to make another base of a spindle shade. We tend to make the same style of pieces in batches, so we try and get them as similar to each other as possible. What Hannah's doing now is getting the end of the blowing iron nice and hot, and she's going to attach a very concentrated piece of coloured glass on the end of the blowing iron. This is the way that we colour all of our pieces. So we heat that up and get that nice and molten again, and then we'll put a little bubble of air into that solid piece of coloured glass. Let that cool down a bit, and then gather the clear glass from the furnace over the top, and then as you inflate your object, you get the skin of colour on the inside.
So where does that glass actually come from?
That glass, the coloured glass, comes from New Zealand, and the clear glass comes from Germany.
And with something as fragile as this, and with something that requires so much care, do you have a problem with wastage? I mean, does a lot of stuff come out to a standard that you're not really happy with?
There's with glassmaking, I think there's, from the moment you pick the iron up to the moment that the box goes out the door, there's a point for it to go wrong. That's something that I think is really important for people to think about.
So, I mean, how does England measure up in this industry? I mean, Italy, Murano glass is always really famous. How does this country kind of measure up?
I think we've got lots of traditions around cut crystal and lead crystal and those kinds of industries. On a studio level, I mean, the studio glass movement is quite young, really, in this country still. For studios of this kind of scale, they started really in the 70s. Mm-hmm. There were factories, but not sort of the studio sort of scale. Mm-hmm. And I think I think we hold our head in the world industry for this kind of thing. And there's, you know, I think a lot of, on the sort of, certainly on the artistic scale of things, there's a lot of successes that happen from UK-based artists.
Because traditionally, as you say, there's been a long kind of tradition of glassblowing in the UK. Is that right? I mean, going back how long?
Yeah, I mean, that goes back a really long time. On a sort of industrial scale, you know, that there's a big heritage. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's something that we look at massively. We try and sort of draw from that and respect that and be a part of that, really. Mm-hmm. But adding that contemporary side to it. But yeah, I mean, I think that's something that I'm mindful of, that I really want these skills that I've spent my time learning to stay in this country.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess it's kind of a testament to, you know, what training and real hard work can do, as opposed to just kind of producing a luxury thing. It's all about the training, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, that's why I find this so satisfying, because it's a combination of many things. I like to think we make beautiful product. Mm-hmm. I think we make it really well. Mm-hmm. And I think we sell it to interesting people. Mm-hmm. Doesn't get any better than that, really.
That was Mark Bickers of the UK-based glassblowers Rothschild & Bickers with our own Adrian Craddock. With five generations of British Columbian loggers in her family history, Alana Husby was always destined to go into the wood industry. Where the lumber business often sees useless pulp, Alana sees unique furniture. And so she turned her chainsaw to salvaging wood in the province. Now she's seeing what lies beneath by reclaiming underwater jungles flooded to create the Panama Canal and a hydro dam. Lucy Hislop catches up with her at the Vancouver showroom of Coast Eco Timber.
I'm leaving behind the thrum of the Oak Street Bridge and flight path for Vancouver International Airport and entering into the jungle that is Coast Eco Timber's showroom. Vertiginous slabs of gary oak, maple and walnut stand 17 feet tall against the walls. Suspended above, a giant cut-off willow branch acts as a canopy. All the design of company president Alana Husby. As we tour the parade of wood, the 37-year-old runs her hands over each piece and even has me sniffing the western red cedar with her. Sawdust is clearly in her blood.
I'm a fifth generation BC logging family. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, everybody worked in sawmills in the logging business. We'd always talked about logging and forestry around the table growing up. I lived in a logging camp at the north end of what is now the Haida Gwaii or the Queen Charlotte Islands. It was 50 loggers and my mom and my dad and I in a 12-foot trailer on the beach.
Today, her last name is synonymous with a large, privately held forest management group owned by her late father. While his daughter qualified as a forestry technician and learned about cutting, grading and selling lumber products through the family and other firms in the industry, she started to see wood a little differently. The idea for her own company started with a stint working at the dry land sort, where logs are graded and sorted for market.
Well, while I was working in the business in British Columbia, I noticed the piles of waste, which is natural, it's normal for the industry. And I was always obsessed because I'd look at a pulp log and my guys would see a pulp log, but I'd see a piece of furniture or I'd see like a chaise. That's when I was inspired to do something with the waste. I used to rescue wood from rivers, lakes, oceans. I'd work with beachcombers in British Columbia, rescue logs. I'd get calls from little old ladies in West Vancouver. Alana, there's a dogwood going down, come rescue. So we'd send trucks and mill it up and just rescued wood.
As her showroom's collection of hardwood such as Ipe and Zapatero testify, soon her salvaging was not just limited to BC. A few years ago, friends in the industry mentioned underwater logging in Panama.
In 1903, Teddy Roosevelt dammed the Chagres River. When he did that, he flooded a jungle the size of Montreal, and it was a whole standing jungle under there.
After finding the company logging the underwater area, she started to buy and ship the wood up to BC.
They were always in trouble for money, so I was always backing them. Finally, I just ended up buying them out through a series of events.
So just how do you begin to log underwater? So
we have barges with compressors on them for air, and we have hydraulically powered chainsaws. So the chainsaws are powered by the air compressor. We lubricate them with a vegetable oil. My guys, they feel their way down the log, they guy line the log to these big floating tanks, then they cut the log. The log shoots up, but then it sinks right away. So they have to hook it onto the barge and move on to the next.
It may be hard to picture, but some of those logs are 12 feet in diameter and 60 feet tall. Today, she also has a 15-year permit to underwater log 15,000 hectares in the nearby Lake Baiano. Why does she think she's been able to expand operations there?
Well, I bought existing Panamanian companies, which was very helpful. That was a great start. And then I proved that we were here to stay. I've got the underwater logging company and I've got the sawmill. This new concession came up at Lake Baiano, and we were the only people. Everybody else has kind of failed at this in Panama as far as underwater logging, and I think it's because they're divers. They're not wood people. You need the contacts all over the world if you want to move this. You need a buyer for every single piece, and Panama locally can only take a certain amount, so you have to know your stuff all over the world.
To her mind, making sure the wood was rated by the Forest Stewardship Council, the lumber industry's environmental seal of approval, was essential, as well as being able to mill in Panama and export BC logging expertise.
We run very lean and mean, which is a British Columbia logging practice. You have to run hard, you have to run lean and mean. I don't have printer or colored printers, I don't fly first class. Like, I'm very cognizant of the bottom line. And that's from being a logger's daughter, I think, and my dad starting with nothing. I saw that, and I want to hold on to my money. Definitely limiting the middleman power within our company. We can sell right to the end user, whether that was architects, designers, developers, housewives. We really went to the end user. We saved them money. We made more margin ourselves.
We slip out of her showroom to visit her neighbors on the industrial estate, Woodrow's Woodworking, typical of the mill workers that helped customize some of her salvaged BC and Panamanian wood. The bandsaw is in full speed today. But it took Husby time to figure out the underwater wood.
How do we kiln dry this? What's the cell structure? How does this work? How hard is it? What can we make with this? And we do a lot of commodity products. I think I'm the largest commodity producer in the country of 1x, 2x stud product, concrete forms. I call it the non-sexy stuff. It's the building, the bones in the building.
Beyond restaurants and architectural projects, Coast Eco Timbers wood has even been used in the construction of a dam. According to the 37-year-old Husby, making the business work is down to a simple philosophy.
I read somewhere once that you should always hire people smarter than yourself. I managed to build a very strong team in Panama, and I don't have a big ego. I'm not afraid to say I don't know something. I'll go talk to the best. As long as I win, I don't care who's right.
As I leave her talking to the experts working the industrial-sized sanders, I see that business ethos hard at work. For Monocle, in Vancouver, this is Lucy Hislop.
Now, each year, the World Retail Congress brings together CEOs and executives from around the world to discuss trends and concerns in the retail industry. Something that's almost always on the agenda is trying to discern the store of the future. The most recent Congress held in London saw one of the biggest names in sportswear offer their take. Adidas's virtual footwear wall is a large-scale touchscreen that allows customers to browse the brand's enormous catalogue of products with a swipe of the wrist. Chris Aubrey is the Director of Commercial Experience at Adidas. He told Monocle's Adrian Craddock how the wall isn't designed to replace the traditional shopping
experience. One of the areas that we're exploring for sure is more this area of omnichannel and creating a better experience for the consumer and connecting the digital world to the physical world. So the virtual footwear wall is really an example of that.
Can you explain what the virtual footwear wall is?
Sure. At its heart, it's really an enhanced e-kiosk in the store. But what we'd noticed is that the way that most people had brought their e-com operation into the store until now has been to literally put a touchscreen in the corner and put their website on that, and that's it. Essentially, what we're doing with the virtual footwear wall is kind of the same. We're offering products available via e-com on a touchscreen. It's just that we're bringing it right into the heart of the store experience. So what you can do is basically browse the products in full size, in real size, right next to the physical products. You can shop them and you can buy them directly from the wall. And the idea that we have there is that it should be as close as possible to having the real product in your hand. That's what we're trying to do.
So what exactly is the point? If you've got the physical product there, why would people be interested in kind of flicking through it on a touchscreen?
Well, okay, so there's a couple of different answers to that. The reason why we created it in the first place was because we make about 8,000 articles per season. And in a store, you can stock about 300. So there's a mass of products that we offer that you can never get in one of the stores. So what we set out to do in the beginning was to extend that physical product range in the store so you could have a bigger range, a bigger selection for the consumer. Because what we have seen from research we've done is that of the people that come in the store, a fair percentage leave because they can't find the product they wanted. So that's the first part. The second thing is, in a lot of cases, you have a physical product available in the store, which is also on the wall, but in the store you've got maybe one or two colours available. On the wall you've got maybe 10 or 12. So what people might do is shop the physical product, see a product that they like, but not in the colour they want, and then use the wall to find the colours they want.
So is your aim to replace physical products in the store on display with these walls?
No, not to replace, to enhance. I don't think that the right way forward is to reduce or eliminate physical product from the stores. I think the right way forward is to optimize the range and balance it correctly between physical and virtual. But ultimately, the consumer still wants the element of instant gratification, of being able to pick up the product and take it away there and then, to be able to see it, to touch it, to feel it. I don't think it's right to eliminate that. However, what it does do is give us the opportunity to maybe test new retail locations very easily. We can test pop-up locations, we can go to places where we've never been before with a retail operation, because we can literally drop the virtual footwear wall in there and instantly open a store.
Okay. So, I mean, how effective has the wall been? I mean, it's been implemented for about a year now, it's toured around the world. What are the results that have come back?
The first test we did in Oxford Street, we pre-sold one product in two different colours, and we sold in one store in 2 weeks the same that three stores sold in six, which is the equivalent of about a 500% increase in sales. We've tested it then a couple of times in other stores as well, and we've seen the same kinds of results again, so double digit increases in sales, sometimes triple digit increases. What we're also seeing is a trend of people spending more per purchase. So where they came in to maybe spend £100, they might upgrade that to £140. So the two key things are, we're selling more in terms of sheer quantity and in terms of value.
So it seems a little bit like a novelty at the moment. I mean, it's not in every Adidas store. Do you think it will become the norm, or is this really just kind of a special thing?
I guess that depends on a number of different answers or questions that I don't necessarily have the answer to yet. I think it might become more commonplace. Will it become ubiquitous across all stores? I have no idea. All depends on a lot of different business questions and size and scalability, etc. Would I like for it to go a lot broader? Yes, of course, because it offers a better experience for the consumer, and if we can offer that in more locations, it's better for the consumer.
That was our Adrian Craddock at the World Retail Congress. We'll be back with some management advice and our weekly branding chat right after this short break.
Entrepreneurs make new money. We protect it until it becomes old money. Pictet, experts in wealth management since 1805.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. As you'll likely know, every now and then on The Entrepreneurs, we like to pick the minds of the business world's best and brightest to see how they make decisions, navigate the boardroom, and let loose in those rare downtimes. Monocle caught up recently with Nicholas Lander. In the world of food and drink, Nicholas Lander is known as the restaurant insider. That's his weekly column in the Financial Times. A consultant and writer, Nick's book, The Art of the Restaurateur, profiling 20 of the top names in the industry, is out now. He also happens to have been one of Britain's top restaurateurs. He was the man behind the famous L'Escargot restaurant in London's Soho district in the 1980s. Nick popped by the studios recently to tell us the tips and tools he used to navigate both the kitchen and the business world.
I'm self-employed and have been for the last 20 years, so my desk is me. I never travel without it, and I can't really leave it. I look at my emails before I make my wife a cup of tea in bed at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I switch off at 11 o'clock at night. I was very fortunate. I went to an MBA in Manchester, studied an MBA in Manchester, with the words of my late father echoing in my ears, which were that you can go to all the best schools in the world, but it's only the University of Life that teaches you the most important decisions and how to take them, and I think he was right. My management style is very simple. I want to treat people and intend to treat people as I would like to be treated myself. As far as tough decisions are concerned, they're never best taken by a single person. I was told at a very early age by my father's partner never to go into business on your own. First of all, because you always need somebody else to blame. And second of all, because having a partner means you can always stall on a decision. And that's incredibly important to allow you to think through the implications. The biggest mistakes of my career, my professional career, have always been when I've taken a decision on my own. I'd like to be liked as much as respected. I don't think really one goes without the other. In terms of support, one of the great advantages of not having created too many enemies over the last 30 years I've been in the restaurant business, I think, is that I can always turn to people for advice in the way that I hope that they can in turn turn to me. My wife and I travel a lot. She's a wine writer. Laptop, BlackBerry, pen and paper, and not necessarily in that order. I haven't read a management book for some time. It's a weakness and something I need to rectify pretty quickly. As far as the morning's concerned, it starts after I've made this famous cup of tea for my wife with 45 minutes of Tai Chi. Yes to wine with lunch, it makes the food taste better. And as my team is my wife, I always try and socialise with her. And as far as key management advice is concerned, I think it really comes back as the key of any good restaurant is to caring for people. If you care for them, they will respect that and care for you and your team.
That was writer, consultant and former restaurateur Nicholas Lander. Time for our weekly branding chat now, where our colleagues at Wink Creative mull over a branding problem and a solution. This week, we chatted about London-founded hairdressing chain Tony and Guy with Tom Morris and Matt Adams.
Well, Tony and Guy is a global hairdressing and training business founded by two brothers in London. And to date, there's over 420 salons in 42 countries. They're the official sponsor of London Fashion Week, apparently, but they don't really kind of emphasise this fact. And I wouldn't say they've done badly as such or that they failed. They seem to be thriving, but we think that it could be on the horizon.
And Tom, they are very prolific. I mean, they are featured in every high street, certainly in the UK.
Yeah.
Where are their other bases around the world? Where do you know that they have a foothold?
I think globally. I mean, that's why they're such an interesting sort of brand to talk about, because they are obviously, I think, really successful at the moment. Maybe it's just a UK perception, but to me they just seem, I can't quite believe as soon as the 1990s ended that they didn't.
Their trick was to capitalise on that market, to make a salon hair sort of dare we even say the word dye, because most ladies who go there probably wouldn't use dye, they'd use tint. But they definitely made that sort of part of culture, and then they had this amazing phenomenon, their globalised brand.
Absolutely.
Do you think that they that makes them weak in their identity in any way?
No, because I think, I think around the world, that look, I think, when you hear the word Tony and Guy, you automatically associate it with sort of avant-garde hairdressing.
Yeah, they're
and I think that look of the triangular fringes and things around the world, still people are still asking for that, and they're still probably going to Tony and Guy and thinking that is the kind of the cutting edge of coiffures today. It is just a case of perception, I think. Obviously very successful, but have they moved with the times? You kind of, just looking through their website and the sort of the styles they're parading, it's, they don't look anything like they did in the 90s, but there's just something away and they fashion themselves and the way they broadcast themselves, which hasn't moved on since the 90s.
So Matt, tell me what you think they need to do to sort of regain that sense of contemporary hairdressing. Like, what is so dated about them, and why don't you have any hope for their longevity as a brand?
When you look at their advertising, for example, it's very much, it's all these kind of short cropped red haircuts that almost look like Shockwaves adverts, and it's very much, it does feel sort of still stuck in the 90s. And if you consider, for example, we were talking about Joe & Co in Soho here in London, and how they use a lot of sort of slightly grittier photography, almost blog-like photography, so it's black and white. It's very much about the haircut against sort of a brick wall. And that's kind of what you want. It feels current and it feels ongoing and keeps moving.
Mm. What are your fixes for Tony and Guy? I mean, we've talked about the sort of more holistic image of the brand. What's some real points that you would prescribe to Tony and Guy to try and fix this?
Well, I think in a way, and it's not an unsuccessful company, but I think part of its sort of image crisis is that it's a victim of its own success. Mm. It's too big for itself. You know, a haircut is a really, really personal thing. It's like going to the dentist. People get upset about when they have to go for a haircut, just in case you come out with a bad one. It's like gyms. If you kind of push the personalities in the gym forward, like the personal trainers, they're the people bigger than Fitness First or bigger than Virgin Active. And I think in a way, you know, Tony and Guy needs to do that, kind of take the name back a bit and let the hairdressers and the actual what goes on inside stand out a bit more.
A bit like what Starbucks has started to do, with customising each one of its coffee shops to make it feel like independent.
I mean,
it's a bit fraudulent in a way, because we know this is cynical, a globalised multinational.
Yeah, exactly.
More of a personal touch.
But it's an effort to do that at least, and kind of that's the way elements of retail seem to be going at the moment.
But when you consider hairdressers as well, you don't necessarily go to a particular hairdressing company to get your hair cut. So you go to an individual.
Yeah.
You go to your hairdresser, or you might know two guys who work at one particular place. You don't necessarily go to a Tony and Guy, no matter where it is.
Mm.
And I think pushing perhaps the team that work within each sort of individual salon is a good way forward.
What do you think of the typography and the typeface and the brand, the Tony and Guy concept?
I think really iconic, and I think that. I mean, that's...
I don't have a problem with it at all, really. Mm. I don't think they should necessarily change the logo, because it's very recognisable. Mm. And people connect with it. But I think perhaps the way it's applied and its positioning, so everything surrounding that logo and the identity could be changed.
And that's all we have time for this week. This show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. Our studio manager is Holly Fisher, and I'm Sophie Grove. Please feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or feedback, and you can reach me at sgr@monocle.com and our producer Daniel at dg@monocle.com. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for more inspiring news and views from entrepreneurs around the world.